Hey everyone, I'm Lauren.
And I'm Nicole.
And this is Fostering Forward with Nick and Lo.
A podcast hosted by two foster moms who believe in fostering to reunify,
fostering the whole family,
fostering change,
and most importantly, fostering growth in yourself.
Our hope is that this podcast will be an invitation for you to join us in radical foster parenting.
Let's get started.
Ooh, this is going to be cute because it's still the tail end, at least, of Autism Appreciation Month.
We are going to actually make it in the right month.
Yeah, and it's April, you guys. It's Autism Appreciation Month while we're recording this. You might have heard it called Autism Awareness Month. And we would like you to consider rephrasing because adults with autism would really like us to lean more towards, you know, supporting neurodiversity this month and celebrating rather than, you know, some of the stuff that's been done in the past, and we support that. So happy April. If you're listening to this not in April, this is still a really important topic.
Yeah.
Yeah. We're going to talk about fostering autistic kids today, but we wanted to give an overview of our experience working with and raising autistic kids. We are not experts. Neither of us are autistic, so we're not the real experts anyway, but we do have some lived experience with parenting kids with autism. So, you know, we'll go over that a little bit so you know, like, where we're coming from as we're talking about this.
Yeah. Do you want to start?
Yeah. Okay. So I'm a special education teacher for money. Don't get paid to be mom, unfortunately. So I've worked with a lot of autistic kids in my career. And then my first foster parenting experience, I had two brothers and the youngest was autistic. And he was a speaking little guy who, you know, loved his special interests. He loved sharks. He loved cars. He loved lighting up his cars. So definitely the type of person with autism who is very chatty, but mostly about his specific interests. And he did have a lot of sensory needs and was a very unique and awesome guy and still is. And then I also have a now almost 7-year-old whose primary disability is autism, and he's really great also, very different than the other little guy that I raised who had autism as well. So that's been interesting. What about you?
Well, I don't have any experience fostering autistic children. However, I did birth one.
Cooked them up yourself.
I sure did. I baked that tism right in there. But yeah, so my almost 4-year-old was diagnosed with autism like a year ago, almost a year ago. But I mean, you could definitely, he had some things going on before that, like we basically went for the diagnosis for a formality, which like I think we'll kind of talk about. Mm-hmm. But yeah, I mean, we've kind of been figuring that out. It's different, but also...
Well, we're going to talk about the fact that, like, I think a lot of people think that trauma and autism look the same, but they don't always or really even that often. And so we'll talk about that. That's one of our subtopics. But it's interesting because I do think you still have a ton of relevant experience to this topic, even though your little guy isn't in foster care. Like it's still,
I think a big thing is like try to avoid, first of all, just kids with disabilities.
Like foster parents, you mean? Like,
yes. Yeah. Fostering disabled kids is like kind of
whole thing,
a taboo thing in itself, but then also like, people will intentionally avoid some specific disabilities. And I mean, we didn't, but like I ended up with one anyway. And so like, I think that
you would have been open to it through foster care, but your uterus was like, don't worry.
We got you covered. But yeah, so I think I was 21 when I had Carter and like, I did not have any like background working with disabled children or adults, just outside of like my friends. And so, you know, like, I think that that's kind of like a cop out.
Mm-hmm. So basically why this is an important topic, guys. So fostering autistic kids is, I don't know, foster care is pretty ableist, and 1 in 54 kids in the US are autistic. So some of them unfortunately are going to end up in the foster care system, and, you know, disabled kids have a really hard time finding homes. I mean, oh my gosh, I could rattle off like 10 heartbreaking stories. I literally just talked to, I was telling you earlier, our placement worker at our foster care agency today, because we got a new one and she wanted to go over what our family's parameters are and like what we're open for right now. And I asked her like what the highest need areas are in our area right now. And she said, well, as always, teens is a big one and autistic kids. And I did not like tell her anything yet about our family. She just like told me that. And so she said, it's really, really hard to get anyone to be open to taking an autistic kid, which is really heartbreaking. So yeah, we're going to talk about some of why that is, but autism in general, there's a lot of misinformation and, you know, just prejudice against autistic people in our whole society. Mm-hmm. And that bleeds into foster care because people are specifically resistant to that disability more than others. And you guys can see, like, if you ever look at waiting child photo listings, and I know a lot of people ask me, like, Lauren, when you look at waiting child listings, like, how do you tell if a kid is autistic? And I think some of that's just from work. Like, if you look at a write-up of a child and, like, you know, if I see a write-up, I can usually tell. Or, like, if there's a video clip, I can usually tell, like, that kid's probably on the spectrum. Or sometimes it's, like, very much obvious and evident. But, you know, even just guesstimating, there are a ton of kids with disabilities waiting because, unfortunately, those are the kids that don't end up getting adopted by their foster parents if they need that. And then they don't end up finding homes. And autistic kids just seem to be even more overrepresented. And that really sucks because autistic people, you know, they need that support and stability so much. Yeah. So, you know, this is an important topic. We want to basically share some of our experiences and clear up some misinformation so that hopefully more people that are fostering will consider kids with autism. And, you know, it won't be the situation that we're in now where, you know, so many of them don't have a stable placement.
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. So
sorry.
I did a Q&A on my Instagram and then I promptly lost the results, but lucky for you guys, I did remember quite a few of your questions. And so one of the questions I got was, how do you support and help an autistic child that's coming into foster care? So I'm going to share a couple of things that I've done with the boys that I've raised. And then I think, Nicole, you'll have still some really good insights because even though your guy has been with you his whole life and he doesn't have a trauma history, like, you know, you guys still do a lot to support him in the home.
Yeah.
And you do a lot to support my kid in your home because you watch him. So how to support and help an autistic kid. So I think initial placement, I think you just have to really you know, keep an eye on like safety first and body language are what first comes to mind. So when I first met my first little guy that had autism, I would say safety first, body language, and don't assume anything. So when I met him, he was not speaking. And something that people don't know about autistic people is they will be non-speaking during times when they're overwhelmed or having a sensory overload or anxiety. And that doesn't mean that they're non-speaking all the time. Mm-hmm. So I have a son who's non-speaking most of the time and isn't physically capable of making words. But this little guy is totally chatty and was at that age too. But at age 5, when he was being emergency placed, he was not capable of speaking that evening. So he was doing a lot of like crawling under chairs, growling at us and like not wanting to come out. And the staff was really taken aback because I had some experience with autistic kids. I knew to just like sit kind of near him and like, you know, like just kind of have a gentle aura. And like, I got a couple things out of my purse that he might want to, you know, mess with. And he crawled out eventually and started fucking with like something from my purse and like stimming, you know, repetitive movements called stimming or, you know, something that autistic people will do to like calm themselves down. And so he chilled out and I didn't like push him to speak. I wasn't pushing for eye contact or giving him a lot of eye contact because that can stress some people on the spectrum out. And then I just kind of I didn't try to touch him a lot because I didn't want to freak him out. I didn't know what type of sensory issues he might have, but I did keep a really close eye on him and kept him at arm's length as we went to the car, because one thing that's really common with autistic kids is eloping. So running away really suddenly, and I didn't want him to get hurt. After a couple days together, I was able to bond with him more and it became apparent that he was very verbal. But I did kind of have to use, you know, less words and more body language to calm him that first night. So I think on initial placement, it's just like, also don't underestimate their ability to be sensory seeking, because I feel like a lot of autistic kids can really get into things that you wouldn't think a kid would get into. Or like with the elopement thing, like you just kind of have to keep a closer eye, even if they're older and it might seem like they have more age appropriate behaviors. It's just really, you don't want to underestimate those things and then have an autistic child that's recently placed with you like run out of the home and get hurt or lost. So yeah, basically gentle body language. And then the expectations piece, don't assume anything. That don't just be like, oh, well, they're autistic and they are non-speaking right now in the initial night that they're with me, so they're nonverbal and I'm going to get a device. It's like, you know, just get to know them first. And I think once So yeah, I guess that's my main tips for initial placement. Do you have anything to add to like the first few days, first few weeks, and then we can kind of move on to like long-term support?
I don't have anything really to add to initial placement, just because that's not something that I've experienced.
Right. You had kind of a head start with him coming out of your vagina.
But I do think, right. But literally head start. Well, no.
Well, actually.
He was, you know, sliced out. But
sliced out.
Something that I think that I've seen just in like our community of foster parents in the first couple of weeks is, again, like you said, well, something. So Carter today had an appointment, didn't say anything. So Carter's like pretty much non-conversational, but has a
lot. He's very conversational. He just doesn't do
it. He has a lot of words and is really good at expressing his needs and his wants.
He does go non-speaking in certain settings, though, or if he's nervous.
He did not say anything other than wagon the whole time, because we've got his little wagon that he likes to hang out in the entire time we were at the doctor's office. And that's pretty consistent. So like, you know, I do think the doctor would assume that like he doesn't say anything. And I think that that's kind of something that I've seen when like our friends have a new kid in their home. There's a lot of like push to get a lot of services before you really even know the kid. And there will be some things that are obvious, I think.
No, that's a really good point though. Like when you're caring for an autistic kid in foster care, do get services, and we're going to talk more in a little bit about which services we feel like are most affirming and best for autistic children, but don't front load necessarily, because like just like all children, autistic kids need to bond with you. They need to feel safe. They need to feel calmed down from whatever tumultuous situation brought them into care.
And any services that you try to put in place, if you don't have like the just general like safety and regulation, they're not going to be successful.
Right. So like, so basically don't rush out to be like, oh my God, I got an autistic kid, I'm going to get everything, like every therapy known to man. It's like, that's not actually like,
And also again, like, I think people default into like autism and like swings. So they're like, oh, like I need to get swings. But like, there's lots of kids who do not enjoy swings.
Well, also, let's talk about sensory support when we're talking about support and help. So like, I do feel like a lot of people lean towards swings, but I feel like other people don't even know what to have in a home for an autistic kid. Yeah. And I have to say our youngest did teach me a lot, because my first little autistic guy, but you're right, his sensory supports, that's so like true. Like my first little guy that I cared for, his sensory supports looked very different. He needed a lot of gross motor activities outdoors. He loved to bike. He needed a lot of climbing time at the playground. But his big thing was small special interest objects. So he had to have
like trinkets.
Yes. Oh my God. He had to have his guide. It was a different guy every 4 to 6 weeks, and it would switch based on his special interests. So autistic people and kids, most of them have very intense focused interests, and it's, you know, similar to other people's passions, but it's just got that little special kick to it. And so he was really, he would be obsessing over like, like certain characters like Spider-Man, and then he would switch to sharks. And like, there were some that stayed over years and years and others that would switch. But he had his guy's box, which was a box of little figurines, and he would keep them all in there. And there would be one guy, like little toy that he would pick that was special. And he had to have that with him everywhere he went. And I really fought against that for a long time. And then I got some education and was like, okay, this really is important to him. Like, he has to have it. It's a coping object. And so like, that was more his thing. He didn't really, and then he did need like a little bit of like an autism proofed house. Like he had to have like, you know, he wasn't as sensory seeking as my kid that I'm raising now, but like he definitely had to have some barriers and boundaries in the house so that he couldn't like be in the bathroom unsupervised or be in the kitchen unsupervised, because he would just get sensory seeking and be like, you know, bathing in a bucket of, you know, maple syrup before I could even figure out what to do. But my youngest that I have now, we had a learning curve with him because he needs a lot of like vestibular inputs, like swinging, rocking, spinning. So we had to buy and install a lot of swings, swing frames. We got an exercise ball to bounce on. We've considered getting an indoor trampoline, or just like throwing the whole house away and going and moving into a trampoline park. We're not going to do that though. But basically like we've had to get a lot of in-home sensory supports. And I do feel like, and you kind of have dealt with this too, as Carter's gotten older, if you're planning on being open to autistic kids, at least I wouldn't buy everything now, because like you said, they are all interested in different things, but I would know, number one, I would know of a play space or an occupational therapy space or somewhere in your community that you can book a session to go and play and figure out what is mm-hmm. going to be most helpful for sensory regulation. And then I would have a plan for how to get some of this stuff in place pretty quickly, because one thing that's really important with supporting autistic kids is giving them sensory regulation tools. And so if you have a home that's set up to do a lot of whatever helps them calm down and regulate their system. I keep forgetting too, like, people are going to be at different levels with what they know when they're listening to this, but basically like autistic kids need to regulate their sensory system differently than typical kids. Some of it's kind of similar though, but like, and a lot of autistic kids are going to have very specific needs for sensory regulation. You might have a kid that needs to feel Play-Doh consistency stuff all the time, or loves tabletop sensory bins and has to have like a couple hours of sensory bin time every day to feel good. Or like my kid has to be able to swing and rock every single day for several hours a day, or he doesn't feel right and his behaviors are off the chain and he's, you know, like really upset all the time. You know, you might need a kid that needs you to crack their back all the time. Like, so like their sensory systems need certain tools in place. And so that's something to know, like know how you're going to figure out what works for them, and know, have a plan for getting those supports in your house so that your house is like a safe zone for them where they have lots of choices for self-regulation tools.
Yeah. I think to add on to that, something that, again, because like our home, you know, I had a bunch of little kids prior to Carter. I had been parenting for a couple of years, but also something that, like, you know, everything we have that kind of helps support Carter in our home now is available on Amazon. We do a lot of, you know, 2-day shipping, but also we've changed it a lot. Mm-hmm. Carter's room started one way.
And like more of like, a typical baby toddler room.
And has slowly morphed in different phases. Like he had a swing in his room for a little while. I think it's still hanging now that I think about it, but like he doesn't really get in that as mm-hmm. much. He's also like changed like the style of swing that he likes. He really liked the compression swing. Whereas now he just like wants
that do be so true. My kid does that too. Like they'll switch it up on you. That's the other thing, is you'll find something that works and then their system will need something different. And you're just like, fuck. Like
I think something to kind of just like add to supports in your home, I feel like sometimes it can sound really intimidating or overwhelming mm-hmm. because there is a lot of like unknowns, and you have to, it's like it do be a little hard to like figure out your kid. But also, like, to me, my favorite part of parenting all of my kids is like watching them experience the world and like helping them have the best experience that they can for like their little life. And like with Carter, interacting with him and watching him and like mm-hmm. finding his little quirks and his little like interests and his like his sensory things, and like that is part of
loving him, like you said, like
yeah,
you
like all your honoring kids. Your kid.
Okay, so we've got like initial placement stuff, you know, creating a safe sensory supportive environment. Oh, safety first too. Like,
yeah,
I said it a couple times, but like you're going to need higher placed door chains. You're going to need maybe like a combination lock thing on your, like our kids are smaller now, but like, you know, as they grow, like we're going to have to get pretty creative. Don't underestimate. And again, I don't want to say this to be intimidating. Like Nicole said, all this stuff can be figured out at Lowe's or Amazon, but like you really are going to, with a lot of autistic kids, you're going to need to have some elopement barriers in place. So like that means
And they really, in my experience, my kid sees things that I don't. And so like, you know, we did have, he was in a crib for a really long time because he liked the security and like the feeling of that. And then he got a little bit too big to be in there. So we switched it to like the toddler bed, but then he's a giant. So he was just too long. So then when we switched him to his twin bed, it was a lot for him. And also he could like free roam in his room. And so like, he knows how to open the doorknob. So we had to put a doorknob cover. So it's like, okay, I solve that problem for now until he learns how to open the doorknob, and like they'll do it once and be gone. But then, and so like you really have to be diligent, and we have a camera in his room.
Mm-hmm. I know some counties don't allow that with kids in care, but like honestly, also, you know how, you know us, we're rule breakers. We're not rule breakers,
well,
but we're
I'm a rule follower.
But yeah, you're a rule follower, but you're a system overturner.
Actually, from what I looked into, at least our state stuff, like at a state level, and again, agencies do have stupid
rules. Do be dumb.
Rules,
they be making up their own shit.
But at a state level, as long as they have access to privacy, so the camera can be turned off, or it can
be on the door.
Or
so like,
if they can get changed in their bedroom or in the bathroom. As long as there's like access to privacy, it works out. Mm-hmm. And also like safety comes first for kids
really yeah, like I would suggest emailing their team and being like, okay, well, so-and-so's eating out of here on the regs. So exactly. Like, what do you
but, like, so back to like the room situation, you know, I have the doorknob cover. However, Carter's new thing is he toe walks a lot, like on the very top tip of his toes.
And this baby be walking around like he's got invisible stilettos on yes, all the time.
Like all the way on his toes, like actually tip of his toes.
Like a point ballerina.
And so he has excellent balance. And balances on the like top edge of his headboard, and now is trying to get out of the windows. And like in our home, the windows are not like regular length. They're like high up. And you know, so that's like, we now have to put locks on our windows, which like they lock, but like he knows how to flip it and slide it. And he's three.
You do just have to be so careful though. Cause we yeah. actually have a local friend whose autistic foster son escaped her home and she had a lot of things in place. So like, it's just really, safety first is a big one.
Yeah.
But it's not undoable. It's not something that you can't figure out with a little creativity. And then I think for like, other ways to support and help, and see, a lot of these are side topics we're going to cover, but I think the biggest one is like, learn from autistic adults first and educate yourself on that, on like what that community is advocating for. Cause
yeah.
we've learned the most from, honestly, like we could talk for this whole episode about how to support and help an autistic foster child, but really the only direction I need to point you in is learn from autistic adults.
For
like,
sure.
They've lived it.
There's a lot of, groups that are ran on Facebook ran by autistic adults mm-hmm. and something that I've seen a lot of is there'll be parents who are most of them, when they ask the questions, are neurotypical themselves looking for help because they like don't get it, but I've seen a lot of posts where it's like, my kid is doing this, help, like how do I like keep them safe and also support them. And there is always a bunch of commenters who are like, oh yeah, like I did this, like this is what my parents did, like this is what my parents did and it was awful,
it's so helpful,
this was great, this mm-hmm. worked for me, and this is what I do now. It's like,
we use a Facebook group, both of us, called Ask an Autistic Adult, and that'd be my immediate join if you were even considering fostering autistic kids, because yeah, you can literally search so many topics.
Well, truly, and just in general, I think that more people need to, just so you can like learn, I mean, because I'm sure you'll come across autistic people in mm-hmm. your life, but then also like, I think even if you were just like reading posts by yes. autistic adults, a lot of the like stereotypes or misinformation would be gone.
Yeah. You'll learn what autism can really look like and how diverse it really presents. So yeah, I think that's our overall message, is just like learn from self-advocates and you'll be so much better prepared.
Yeah.
So this is this question kind of overlaps some of what we talked about, but one of the people asked, like, what if it's just trauma and being mislabeled as autism, or like how I felt about kids being diagnosed with autism when they have trauma. And like, I think this person meant really well too. We had a great conversation about it in the old DMs, but basically, like, I think she was of the opinion that like a lot of trauma is misdiagnosed as autism. And I, you know, respectfully, but strongly disagreed. So basically, like, our answer for that one is multifaceted, but one big one is like, it honestly doesn't really matter, because whether a child is struggling with sensory overwhelm, with like routine rigidity, you know, like some of the things that can cause barriers in an autistic person's life that might also cause barriers in a person with trauma's life, I guess a misdiagnosis could have some adverse effects, but honestly, like, ultimately, if a kid needs support, a kid needs support, right?
Yeah. Well, so that's something I think I remember when we got to the point where we were like, okay, like we need to get some services in place. And that's the only, like, we already knew he was autistic. Like it got to a point where like, it wasn't really a question, we knew. And so we went to the doctor for the sole purpose of a diagnosis. But I do remember kind of being like, okay, like what, I knew that we were not into ABA, but I was like, so like, what do I do? Like
are the services?
Kind of like when you, you know, get a new baby and you're like, like a real, like a tiny,
what
like,
do I do
like
an newborn?
Actual infant. And you're like, okay, like I need a bottle so I can feed it because it can't eat food. Like things like that. Like I was like, look, and like, it really just turned out to be like, we ended up doing speech OT and like, we're going to start PT now, which like, kids that are not autistic also need.
Yeah, I think my main answer to the what if it's just trauma is like, unfortunately, so like this person was advocating for not doing that. I don't agree with that. I think if autism is the label you're being offered for a child who is needing support and you're not sure if it's the right label, especially if they're in foster care, I would take what you can get. Because here's the thing, in our society right now, autism is a label that's going to get you a lot more services than PTSD. That's awful. And toddlers with complex PTSD deserve so much help.
The other options also will be is like, you'll get an ADHD, an ODD.
Yeah, you'll get that weird ADHD and other stuff combo, which is like, it's autism.
Which is, yeah. And that's like, that's going to, so I agree. I think you take what you can get. And then
also, especially with foster care, because, okay, story time, my guys that went home, my little guy had an educational diagnosis of autism, but we went to our local autism clinic and they denied him a medical diagnosis because they said, and I quote, "We want you to come back in a year because he has so much foster care trauma and we want to see if it's that or autism," which literally, you guys, his evaluations for autism, he tested well within the range for being autistic on two different evaluations. Yeah. And so literally, like, he was diagnosed with it, but his doctor team would not give him the label. And it ended up his mom, who's low income, when she reunified, didn't have the spoons to fight the system again to try to get the medical diagnosis. And he still doesn't have it to this day. His family lost out on thousands of dollars of Social Security disability income support, which they badly need. And he's lost out on many, many services over the years since. Yeah. And it's a big regret of mine that I didn't fight that battle to the death. I would, if I could go back in time, I would fight to get him the medical diagnosis, and I would have opposed that 1,000%. It was so hard to even get the evaluation. It was a very lengthy process, but I'm very pissed at our local children's hospital. Hey, Nationwide, I'm not shy to shout you out, you dicks, for doing that to him. So basically, like, an autism label, I think can really only help either way. So I don't think it's a concern. And then our other, and I think it's ableist really to be like, oh no, like, what if they're not autistic, but they get labeled that, but it's just trauma? It's like, first of all, there's no just trauma. And second of all, what's wrong with having an autism label? Like, it's not a bad label. So I don't think there needs to be any resistance to that.
And that, I think that kind of, when you read me that comment, I kind of didn't understand like what was even really being asked, because in my mind, like, there's also tons of children who, and I don't know if it, I guess I don't know if it's still going on, but like, I remember when we were kids and like after that as well, there's a lot of people who are like diagnosed with ADHD as a child. And then they like do their own exploring with their, as they get older. And it turns out like they have something else and I think that there was a point to this and I don't remember what it was.
It's like not the end of the world, basically.
Yeah. I think that like,
worst case scenario, they get diagnosed with autism and it's not autism. And like, there's really no con to that.
Well, that's the thing. And then you like get relationships with therapists and they're like, no, like, I don't actually think this is what's going on. I think this is. But to me, oh, that's what it was. So when you read that, I was like, okay, so either, and it sounds like this person was well-meaning, but you're either associating like trauma meltdowns to how autistic people act. Mm-hmm. Which is like super sad and frustrating.
Okay, so basically what you're saying is like people are equating autism to the way that trauma manifests. And like, I agree, we were talking about this earlier, like autism doesn't just look like a hard day, you guys. So like, when you're saying like, oh, what if it's just trauma? It's like, wait a minute, like when someone's getting diagnosed with autism, they're not just having meltdowns where they're, you know, losing control of their body or they're hurting themselves or others. Like, that's not what autism is. Like, autism is not just those moments. Autistic people can have those moments sometimes, especially when they're dealing with a lot or they're not getting the correct support.
Or if they have trauma involved in their life as well. Mm-hmm. Like, that would totally make sense to have some tough days, but it goes, there's so much beyond that. And then my other thought was, okay, so like you're either associating it with like these extreme behaviors, or like you had said before, and it's like, oh, but like, what if like, the diagnosis is gonna like, what if they are not autistic? Like, oh, the horror. And like, that is another big thing too. And I will say, like, I didn't have a lot of experience before. I never felt that way. I have a couple of autistic friends who I was not friends with as a child, but as an adult, so I didn't really have that experience. Like, I don't have a favorite kid, but my whole family definitely has a favorite.
Oh, you mean like your autistic kid is a fan fave?
Yeah. Like, right. He's everybody's favorite.
Well, we were talking sibling. About before, like, we have the unique dynamic where we have sort of similar in age autistic little boys, mine who has been through a hella trauma and hers that hasn't. And my little guy has hella attachment struggles and hers doesn't. And like, you can very much tell when you hang out with those two, at least, what's autism and what's trauma. Cause like Carter doesn't have trauma. So like you can see right. the difference. Like you can see the difference between an overwhelmed 4-year-old with autism who's having a tantrum that's developmentally appropriate to, you know, might not look developmentally appropriate to someone who doesn't know about autistic kids. It might look like more like a 2-year-old tantrum, but like you can tell the difference between that and like him having sensory overwhelm, but like the trauma piece isn't a part of it. And like my little guy with PTSD and autistic sensory overwhelm, like it does present differently. So like I don't think it's valid. And also like, you know, autism also looks like spinning and like having a really cool little hand flap routine and having the cutest facial expressions that are like really zany and really unique. And like,
well, and Carter's a hummer.
Yeah. Musical. Yeah.
He also is
a secret language guy.
He is. And he really likes to like reenact scenes mm-hmm. from shows and like, yeah. you know,
oh my God, the most unhinged and unintelligible yet totally on melody, like
yes.
reenactment of scenes ever. Yeah. It looks like an amazing brain that can remember an entire episode of,
and you know,
Peppa Pig, like word for word.
Exactly. And he knows like his special interest is space. And so like, he knows all of his planets and he knows like weird facts about them and he won't tell you them. But like, if you ask them, like phrase them, the facts as a question, he'll like tell you which planet it belongs to. Yeah. And so like, you know, it's, and
it looks like
he sure does have a lot of meltdowns. Like, don't get me wrong. Like he gets super overstimulated mm-hmm. pretty quickly and he has bad days and he gets frustrated when I'm not understanding what he's trying to communicate, but like, that's not what it looks
that's
like.
That's not
day.
All of him.
And also sometimes his, like specific stims and regulation is his fit. Like that is like, he will scream and that's like making him feel better or, but it's not.
It doesn't just look like when you're talking about just trauma, I can't think of a positive to complex PTSD or attachment struggles due to trauma. Like I'm not saying that kids with that aren't awesome because they are, but like, it's different when you equate that to the disability of autism. That's kind of offensive because like, it's yes. like saying that autism is like, only shitty. And honestly, like complex trauma is only shitty. Like yeah. I can't think of a single thing there's about no it that's like great. Right. So like, that's important to keep in mind too, is if you're working with a competent clinician, there's going to be other tells, other signs that the kid is autistic besides just like things that also overlap with trauma.
Yeah. I think that's a good point. Like hopefully you don't roll into like a developmental pediatrics office and you're like, I think they're autistic. And the doctor's like, well, what's going on? And you're like, oh, they just have all these meltdowns.
And they're like, okay.
And like, they're like, okay, yes, definitely.
It's usually like a multi-day slash week process. Yes. So, you know, obviously shitty clinicians exist. But I, as far as we know, like there's not many areas where that would be happening.
Yeah.
The next question that we have is, does them being in foster care make accessing support for them harder? I would say yes, but honestly, like, you know, this podcast is about shaking up the system and making it better and how shitty it is right now. So like, you guys know that it's no secret that Nicole and I do not think that the foster care system is going great. But it depends on your county, like Nicole's county, for example, where she lives is doing a lot better in terms of like streamlining services for kids and families and reunifications and just everything than where I yeah. live. But,
well,
in
and
general,
speaking of like, yeah. I do feel like regardless of whether you're in care or not, specifically shout out to Nationwide, like they're just kind of shitty all around.
Yes. And so we'll talk about that in a second. Like in our area, accessing help for autistic people in a lot of areas in the United States is actually yeah. specifically for that disability really, really, really hard. And we'll touch on that kind of in conjunction with the next question. But basically being in foster care does make it harder to get services, but that's any child because like you're not the custodial parent. So like, although I will say some services for kids with autism while they're in care, like they don't need anyone to sign off. So like I was able to get my little guy in speech therapy when he was in care.
Yeah.
I was able to get a lot of stuff set up with really no sign off from anyone.
Well,
so.
And that's the thing too. It's not, like I said, I've not fostered specifically any autistic children. However, I have had kids in my home who have needed services and
for other reasons.
And I will say the ones that like I can do on my own actually tend to go pretty quickly. I think because they do prioritize the like trauma piece.
Yeah.
And frankly, like with trauma, kids do tend to be in crisis. And so I think that we get a little bit more prompt when it comes to like some specific services.
But overall, it's harder.
But overall, it's
And I will
hard.
Say there are some services that the door is simply closed to you depending on where you live. I didn't even think of this until we started recording this. But they're like in my county specifically, you can get a waiver through our developmental board of disabilities, and it's for different levels depending on how your kid's presenting, what their needs are, and like how old they are. But that waiver can be really life-changing. Pretty much any like family with a kid with a disability in our city like really strives to get that waiver, because it basically is the difference between like having resources to get providers and like respite care providers that are trained and not having it, or like being able to pay for a specialized summer camp and having to come up with that money yourself. And so like those waivers are life-changing. At least in our county, you cannot get it for a autistic child or any disabled child in foster care. So that is a big, isn't that fucked? Yeah. Like, and I know because I did try, like I got all the way to the top and they were like, we will never give you a waiver when he's in care because he has a stipend. So like that is tough. Like there are certain resources, especially monetary, that like your autistic kid will just never be able to get when they're in foster care. So like that is tough. So yes, it is harder to get services than when you're raising a kid that's not in care. That's definitely the case. Speaking of services, so we're going to talk briefly, not super briefly, about applied behavioral analysis. For those who don't know, it's a very popular therapy. I won't even call it a therapy, but for people with autism that originated, it's a working with autistic people using behaviorist principles to use positive or negative reinforcement. So like reinforcement or punishment to manipulate their behavior to be what you want.
It's like correction therapy.
Yeah. And people can argue with me all you want, but like that's literally the definition. That is what
ABA
the practice of ABA is like. It's a behaviorist therapy. So it's training people's behaviors using reinforcements and punishments, which negative reinforcement is punishment. And we all know that punishment's not trauma-informed. So, you know, ABA is not trauma-informed. And so someone asked, is ABA – so basically, ABA is harmful to autistic people. That's what both of our families believe. That's a very controversial topic right now. I'm sympathetic to why it's controversial, because unfortunately in our country right now, ABA, because of the money that big companies can make off of it, is being pushed as like the only intervention for autistic people.
It's also the easiest service to access.
It is the easiest service to access. And if you are cool with your child, you know, being worked with by people who are using non-trauma-informed principles that are proven to cause psychological harm to autistic people, you can immediately have someone in your home for up to like 40 hours a week to work with them one-on-one. And for a lot of families,
which sounds really relieving. I mean,
yeah, like, when you're struggling, it sounds amazing.
Exactly. And having a bunch of hard days back to back, you're like, wow, if I could have a therapist in here helping me like day to day. And also, I do think that like, unfortunately, like, even you and I fall into this a lot, we do be having some like really ableist thoughts of like, gosh, like if I could correct this behavior or this thing that you're doing, yeah, like my life would be so much easier.
So the reason why ABA is seductive is because, like you said, it's easy access to someone else to, you know, like be one-on-one with them when you're really burnt out. And then also, we're not saying ABA doesn't work. It does for a lot of people. It works on changing their behavior. It doesn't work on helping the autistic person, but it works on changing their behavior. And I think that's what a lot of people struggle with when they're trying to understand why it's bad.
You can see progress.
You can see what looks like progress.
What you would think is progress.
Mm-hmm. And so like our family, this is my last tangent, I swear. Our family has a unique situation with ABA and our autistic son, where my son that was in foster care, we never did it. I'm so grateful that we didn't. Our youngest son in his previous foster homes was in a lot of ABA, sometimes up to 40 hours a week. And so what we saw with him when he first came home is outwardly his behaviors were, you know, like really compliant. But inwardly he was having a lot of challenges. So like one example I can think of off the top of my head is like our son has a lot of food insecurity issues, which we know is really common in foster care. And what was done to him by his ABA therapist was if he threw food during a meal, which is something he would do when he was requesting a different type of food, because he has a lot of sensory food issues. If he was refused more of what he wanted, or if he was requesting a different type of food and wasn't understood, he would sometimes throw his food. They would take the entire meal, all of the scraps, everything that he'd been eating, and take it away at end meal time for up to like a couple hours to like the next meal or snack time. And it was just a lot of rigidity around like when he could eat. They'd never let him request food outside of meal or snack time ever. And he would panic. I had to watch him like when we were doing visits and didn't have custody yet of him. Like he would panic and cry and hit his head on the floor and scramble to grab the food. And they felt very proud of it because they were like, oh, this is just, they called it an extinction burst. Or like the behavior is getting more intense because it's going to dissipate. And I'm like, even if you can train this food traumatized child to sit there and cry silently when you take his food away, that doesn't make this okay. And they did. They got him to sit in terror using a fork and never spilling a drop. And they did get him to mostly stop like throwing food at mealtimes. They also got him, this was a side effect that they didn't notice, but I did, they decreased him asking for what he wanted to eat. Like they decreased him trying to say like, I want more of this or that. And so like their goals were met. They had a clean floor, but my goals were not met. Like his food trauma was being activated. He was clearly like in fight or flight mode during meals. You could see him sitting at the table, like very alert, very tense, very hypervigilant. Now what it looks like in our home is my kid's kind of a sloppy eater, but he does know how to use a fork and he never throws food almost ever, unless he's trying to stim or like he finds that maybe if he poured some water out, it would look silly, but like he throws food very, very infrequently, unless he's having a meltdown about something else. Like I can't remember the last time he did it. It's not a habit anymore. What he will do though, is he'll go get his speech device and he'll ask me for something more using that, or he'll use sign language to ask me, or he'll leave the plate on the counter and go to the fridge and point and use our picture icons that we have on the fridge to ask me for something different. We've seen progress, but it's progress that honors his whole self. And so I think that's the issue with ABA that we really want to hone in on, is like, we're not saying it doesn't work, but we're saying that. And Nicole and I learned this from autistic adults. There is the majority of autistic self-advocates, not every single person, but the vast majority of autistic self-advocates that are adults have been through ABA will tell you like it was traumatizing.
Well, and that's the thing, is like, it's not only is it not trauma informed, but like it is causing trauma.
Right.
Like,
like it's causing additional trauma.
Like for your kids, exactly. Your kids who have existing traumas, like it is not well informed to like help them. But then also kids without existing trauma, it is adding to and creating new obstacles and like new internal,
it's creating struggles. Another layer of trauma on there already. Yeah. So we would encourage you, if your custodial county is pushing ABA, that's never happened to us, but it definitely is something that is pushed in general by like medical professionals and schools a lot. I would say learn from autistic adults first when you're researching ABA. Really dig into the roots of the like methodology. There is something called Reformed ABA right now. There's a lot of practices that are aiming towards reform. There's even a group of autistic self-advocates and behaviorist professionals that on Facebook that like network and talk about. Although I have to say, it's not a super active group, and I don't think it's going to be around much longer, because what usually happens in that group is autistic adults are the things that they're sharing are making the behaviorists quit their fields and like go into other fields, because they don't feel that this like, you know, realm of therapy is even.
Well, something else too, I will say, there's like this positive like hope that I have seen, and I think you and I have maybe talked about this, that there are some parents who like are not intentionally wanting to cause harm to their kid, but they're seeing this like what's seen as societal progress is like what I would say. But like there are also some practices that bill as ABA.
Yes,
that
we
don't
do that.
Really. Mm-hmm.
We have a one-on-one play therapist. We have to bill as ABA because our local Board of Developmental Disabilities will not pay for any other therapy for our autistic
Again,
kids.
Easiest therapy to access.
And so there is, you know, there is that loophole too. So sometimes you can, if you have a county that's pushing for ABA, you can find a way to bill as it and have a different practice or different like methodology used. But you have to be really careful. Like I am very on top of our therapist and I watch her like a hawk but we've had a lot of talks. Once I get to know our therapists, I tend to back off a little bit, but we have a lot of talks about our philosophy on it. So basically, if your county's pushing it, I would be writing up, I'd be doing research, researching within stuff that's been put out there by autistic adults, and I'd be pushing hard against that, because that is not going to be beneficial, and it could compound their trauma. So that's a big issue. I'm trying to think, before we do our shout outs, I guess just because we're done with our Q&A part, guys, I think my final thoughts, and you'll probably have stuff to add to this, I hope you do, is, you know, autistic kids are a wonder. I mean, like I get what it's like to be opposed to getting an autistic kid. My first little guy was an emergency placement, and I did know at the referral call that he had autism. So I was open to it. I had a great experience with him, but I used to say to friends of mine, like, oh, I got lucky with so-and-so, which is disgusting of me to say, but like, I was like, oh, like I can never handle the needs and behaviors of an autistic kid. I had a really ableist mindset of what autistic kids looked like. And I really like I used to say, like, it wasn't my niche. It wasn't a disability that I felt comfortable with long term. And that was just really, like, short-sighted of me. And I will say, like, I'm so glad that I changed my tune on that. I would have missed out on – my youngest is just a wonderful child. I mean, he cracks us up every single day. He's so cute. He's so funny. Raising him is such a joy. And, like, I really, really think that a lot of foster parents are missing out on an amazing journey for however long you would get to work with that kid. Like, there's just something about – being the number one cheerleader and supporter in an autistic person's life. Well, you know, tied with their parents, obviously, but as a foster parent. But, like, it's just a really rewarding time, and I just wish more people were excited about that opportunity as opposed to, like, avoiding it like the plague.
Yeah, no, I agree. I also think that there is a lot – obviously, we know, like, society has a lot of misconceptions about autistic people just in general, but I think that specifically with – kids in care and speaking about foster parents, like, but like if you are modeling positive and like uplifting and helpful things, it helps their parents a lot as well. Mm-hmm. I think that because again there's so many misconceptions and just like we talk about, like, you know, generational cycles and traumas, like a lot of parents have these the same misconceptions that you may
have. Yes, and that's another layer to first families. Like, not only are they having the barriers that brought the kid into care, but they may have, like, a lot of emotions and struggles related to having a kid with autism that you can help them work through alongside you, and that's, like, a big part of your role. Is that what you're saying?
Yes, exactly. And I think that, like, because I think we've seen this too, a lot of biological families, unfortunately, some of the things that go on in the home that cause that lead up to removal is due to overwhelm of not knowing how to support their kid.
Oh my gosh, yes.
And, like, you know, if you're that's like part of the reunification plan. Like, you need to be helping so that everybody is feeling supported and prepared and and positive. And I think that really,
it's rewarding. It's definitely it's a really special. You know, you can change a whole family's legacy forever by helping somebody see the magic in their autistic kid and also helping them to feel supported and functional in parenting them and not feel like they're drowning all the time.
Yeah. Because definitely. Like, also we have lots of spoons and feel that way.
We're drowning some of the time. No. Yeah. Yeah. But okay. And then our final thing would just be shout outs. If you want to learn more, I really, really would consider joining that Facebook group, Ask an Autistic Adult. And then we would love, love, love if you guys would check out our girl Fidgets and Fries on Instagram. That's fidgets.and.fries. Her name is Tiffany. She is a autistic self-advocate, a parent. She talks a lot about the intersection of different systems and different minority groups. She just has so much to offer. And I think that you guys would learn a lot from her. So if you're even considering fostering autistic kids, I would give her a follow as well.
Yeah. And again, I think that you should go beyond that and just, like, educate yourself in general.
Just in general. Yeah. Go follow. Oh my God. Yes. But happy April, everybody. We really, really hope, I know it's the tail end of April, but I hope that you have found a way to, like, celebrate and support the autistic community this month, even if it's just, like, reposting an autistic author's work or, you know, telling a friend of yours that is raising an autistic child, like, hey, so-and-so is really thriving and I'm really proud of them. Or, you know, however that looks for you, make sure that, you know, this tail end of this month, you shout out autistic people because they deserve to be celebrated for who they are. And for our families, it's a really special time. We did have a party for Autistic Appreciation Month, but Nicole's kid was puking, so he couldn't come.
We didn't get to come, but
how sad is that?
He was so sad. You would have loved it too.
Yeah, but so thanks for listening. And I really, really hope that this changes somebody's mind because literally, like, we could cry right now. I'm thinking about, like, all the little faces, all the calls that I've gotten over the last few years of, like, mostly boys. I think one girl that needed an adoptive home. There are so many kids with autism needing foster or adoptive homes, and there are just only two of us. So, like, it's tough to think about all the ones that don't. I actually, our little respite buddy that was with us for just a couple days that has autism, I just found out finally got a longer term foster placement. I'm hoping it'll stick after bouncing around for a really long time and having a really bad experience in a group home where he was actually abused. And then his brother has been institutionalized for like 5 years and will probably never see outside the walls of an institution for the rest of his life. And that's happening to autistic kids all over our country. So definitely horrible.
Right under our noses.
What a note. What a note to end on. Go do something about it, please.
Please.
Please do. Okay.
Yay! Dude, I remember one time. Oh!